Thank you very much for being so patient with us. We were a little long on the floor today, so we're going to start. We had a work session scheduled, but we're going to wait for other members to get here to do that. So we're going to start with our informational meeting. And I have to tell you, we're going to be out of here by 3 o'clock. So. I'll open an informational hearing for the purpose of providing an overview on enterprise zones. It is our honor today to be joined by Mike Burton, Assistant Director of the Oregon Economic and Community Development Department, Arthur Fish, Program Coordinator for the Oregon Economic and Community Development Department. Do you guys want to start? Do we want Larry Glasick or do you want to wait? You guys can do whatever you want. You're here to give us some information, so are you Mr. Glasick? Yes. President of SEDCOR.
Thank you.
Thank you and welcome. Who would like to start? Would you like to start,
Chair
Mr. Burton?
Members of the committee, my name is Mike Burton. I'm the Assistant Director of the State Economic and Community Development Department, and I'm going to try to walk through the Enterprise Zone Program and make it perfectly clear what the program is all about.
Thank you.
Is a very complicated program, probably the most complicated program in the department because the actual tax implications for this, most of what we do is fairly undisciplined, but this one is a little bit different. Please feel free to stop me or any of us at any time and ask questions. Additionally, in the audience are representatives from the Department of Revenue and one of the county assessors to represent the assessors group. So we should be able to answer a complete range of questions. Feel free to stop and fire away.
Thank you very much.
I believe you all have a handout that has about a four-pager. It starts at the top, says, what are Oregon Enterprise Zones? And I'm basically going to talk from the first page.
Okay.
The Enterprise Zone Program is an incentive that was created in the mid-80s at a time when Oregon was coming out of another recession. And before Measures 5 and 47 addressed some of the imbalance in the tax structure. At that time, and largely to this day, the Oregon tax structure is based on income taxes, which corporations pay, and property taxes. It's important from a business perspective to understand that everything they own is taxable as either personal property or real property. So for many Oregon businesses, this tax structure is a heavy burden, particularly as it relates to property taxes. In the 80s, using a model that was being developed around the country, Oregon stepped up and said, we're going to create a property tax exemption for businesses that are willing to make investments in at the time it wasn't called distressed parts of the state, but in parts of the state that are economically lagging, and if they pay exceptionally well, we're going to give them a larger bonus. We're going to give them a larger break and help in order to incent them to do that. So the program was created, and for businesses that are willing to invest essentially in real property improvements, the exemption only applies to improvements. It doesn't apply to assets that are already there. It never applies to land, for instance. It wouldn't apply to a building that's already there. But if the company is willing to build a new building or expand an existing building, put in new equipment, or put in significant pieces of property, they can get an incentive that means they don't pay taxes on property taxes on those assets for 3 years. Okay, that's okay. Essentially how the program works. That's the bottom line and how it works. Moving on, over time, originally I believe there were 10 enterprise zones created. Now there are 47 recognized under the law. Additionally, there is a provision in the law that if communities qualify for a series of federal programs, you'll also consider those to be enterprise zones, and they'll get the same benefit. There's one of those in Oregon, it's Josephine County outside of Grants Pass. And in the last session, the legislature approved the potential to expand enterprise zone capacity for two tribal governments. It didn't actually specify two tribal governments. It laid out a series of criteria which, when applied, open the door for two tribes. One of those tribes, the Confederated Tribes of Umatilla, have sought designation of an enterprise zone. So at this time, there are 49 enterprise zones in the state, and with the exception of the potential for another tribal zone at Warm Springs, all of the zones allowed under the law are currently designated. Those zones have a 10-year life. So after 10 years, the zone terminates, and the department typically solicits a competitive process, and the zone that's terminated, if it still qualifies, and anybody else who qualifies and wants an enterprise zone may compete for the zone. So you need to understand that this is a voluntary process at the local level, and it is usually a competitive process. There have been competitions. I can remember one. There may have been more, but I can remember one where there were four zones of it, or I think it was four zones, but there were the same number of applicants as zones available, same number of eligible applicants as zones available. So that wasn't essentially a competitive process. But all of the other cycles, application processes, have been competitive. It's important to recognize that the jurisdictions that apply for enterprise zone designation are willingly foregoing property taxes for that three-year period.
Can I ask you a quick question?
You bet.
Can you expand an enterprise zone? Can a local jurisdiction expand it?
Chair Smith, members of the committee, a zone has certain geographic constraints. Chief among them is that it can't be larger than 10 square miles. So if a zone is designated for less than 10 square miles, there is a potential to expand the zone. There are other constraints related to distance between parts of the zone. Can't be more than 15 miles gap between any two parts of the zone. There are limitations in the total spread of the zone. Some of those can be waived for sparsely populated counties, which are essentially rural Oregon. But within those constructs, the zone can be expanded. Once it reaches 12 square miles, it can no longer be expanded.
Okay. Does the 10-year limit go back to the initial date, or is the expansion start over, or is it included in the 10 total?
Right.
Okay. Thank you. Continue.
Okay. Having said, Chair Smith, members of the committee, having said that the zone is essentially a local effort, the locals volunteer and compete for this, there is a role for the state, and that falls to our department and to Department of Revenue. Our department solicits applications for these competitive rounds, helps jurisdictions put them together. Usually, and it's important to note that these are not necessarily a single jurisdiction. Typically, there's more than one city, and if it goes outside of the boundaries of a single city, there would have to be county participation. So typically we have multiple jurisdictions involved in this. The department helps them put together their applications, provides technical assistance to them in the application process, and then based on the competitive criteria, makes a selection as to the zones that will be designated and designates the zones. Subsequent to that designation, the new zones go into effect. The last competitive round was held in this biennium. It was held 2001. It was early in this biennium.
Yes, it was held in 2001, and the final designations were done in early 2001. Yeah. Or 2002, early last year.
Early 2002, right. So the department has an active role in terms of designating the zones. Additionally, with the Department of Revenue, the Economic Community Development Department develops administrative rules which include how the geographic rules will be applied and such as that. So jointly we have a role related to administrative rules. So there are a couple of variations on the enterprise zone theme. I'll get into those now. This is where things might start getting complicated. For the main enterprise zone program, there's a reward for firms that pay better than average. And the standard is, we started touched on this on Monday, but if they pay more than 150% of the average county wage, the wage in the county where the zone exists, and that includes benefits, they can negotiate a fourth and or fifth year of exemption. That negotiation happens with the local the zone sponsors, the local jurisdictions, and is meant to take place using an approved set of criteria by the zone sponsors. It's not something that is applied arbitrarily every time something comes up, but essentially they set rules and criteria and apply those to applicants that would seek a fourth or fifth year, and depending on where the company falls out relative to those criteria, they are typically awarded a fourth or fifth year. For urban zones, and there are five urban zones differentiated in statute, there is an opportunity to negotiate further terms and conditions. Rural zones are pretty much straightforward extra fourth or fifth year, but in urban zones there may be additional terms and conditions that can be negotiated. Portland has identified additional terms and conditions. I don't think anybody else has. Eugene did, but it was after the zone had been terminated, so they really don't have any bearing on the current exemptions. Another variation on the theme is what is called the long-term rural exemption. The long-term rural exemption applies to counties with enterprise zones in counties where there is chronically high unemployment and low wages. There's a map on the back of the handout that attempts to identify those. It's no longer in color. But the triangles identify those zones that are located in counties that meet the criteria. In those zones, it is possible to negotiate a 5 to 15 year exemption for very large investments. Very large is defined on a sliding scale and is based on the population and income levels of the community in which the exemption would be negotiated. So the idea is that a very large is different between Linn County or Lake County. A large deal in Lake County is substantially smaller than one in Linn County. So there's a sliding scale, and depending on whether or not the firm meets those size criteria, which are both investment size and employment, the firm may negotiate additional benefits extending 7 through 15 years. On that program, there is also the potential to negotiate with the state, subject to governor's approval, an income tax exemption, again, on the order of 7 to 15 years. So in order to incent very large investments in rural and chronically distressed counties, there's an extra exemption that's available. There's only been one of those so far. That was in Douglas County, and it was Roseburg Forest Products. I think part of that is because this is a fairly new component to the program. It's only 4 years old, I believe, maybe six. And during most of that time, the state's been in a fairly significant recession. There hasn't been a lot of large investments in rural Oregon in that time. But we believe that the program has significant potential, and we'll be coming to you later to ask to move that sunset.
Representative Gagos had a question. And members, if you have questions, let me know.
That question had to do with sustainable salaries. If you're searching for salaries that are 150% of what the current job base is there some formula or mechanism? Because if this, you know, the exemptions, which might be helping to support and sustain that, those increased salaries that I think we saw Monday in that last time, and, you know, some of them are significantly higher than what the base is for the area. You know, after that goes away in 5 years, you know, what's the mechanism to help that company be able to sustain itself with the loss of that exemption and then those considerably higher salaries?
Chair Smith, Representative Gallegos. The mechanism is the one we were talking about on Monday with the bar chart that goes across the page. It is meant to be extraordinarily high pay. If you want an extra 2 years of property tax exemptions, you're meant to pay a lot. There is, except for the long-term rural exemption, which applies only in certain counties, there's no mechanism for extending that benefit. The company could. I'll go back and make another observation about two aspects of the program. It applies to new investments. Those can be absolutely new. The business is new to the zone, so it's a totally new investment. Or it can be an expansion of an existing business. Now, in either case, it might be possible for a firm to continue to earn enterprise zone exemptions into the future if they continue to make investments. So if, to the extent that the firm's growing and making additional investments in plant and equipment, they could earn a longer exemption on those new investments. That would be the only mechanism in most cases to extend that five-year exemption.
If I might.
Okay.
Chair Smith, Representative Galagos, and members of the committee, I think part of the idea is to remember that when a company is weighing the value of getting these additional years of exemption, they're not necessarily going to pay more to do it. It's a question of whether their usual pay scale for that industry is going to be, you know, is sufficient and sustainable in their industry, and then how much more does that 5 year make that place in an enterprise zone that much more attractive. So usually after the 5 years, they should be able to maintain those payroll levels just based on the type of productivity and skills and so forth of their workforce. And we're hopefully just getting them to a certain place by offering them that little bit more because they're so well paying.
Follow up?
Yes.
I don't think that answers my question. What evaluation process looks at the company and those jobs, because it sounds like anybody could say, yes, we can offer these salaries.
Okay.
To know that these salaries will be sustained if...
Chair Smith, Representative Gallegos, the companies are required to report that information to the zone sponsors. We'll have a zone manager. Mr. Glasek is a zone manager, and he is required to verify that information. We're working on a mechanism to verify that information through employment. And employment is offered to help us on that, but there are confidentiality issues. But we do verify the income levels.
That's not quite.
Do you want to wait until Mr. Glasek testifies? Thank you. Representative Marsh, do you have a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just want to clarify, when you say that the property tax exemption is on all ad valorem taxes, that includes the school portion?
Smith, Representative Marks, the answer is yes. All property taxes are exempted for qualified assets for qualified funds.
Okay, and the local sponsoring jurisdiction doesn't have to check with the school district to see whether they concur or not.
Chair Smith, Representative Marks, a change that we made in rules after the 99 legislature was to require that for new zones. So the zone sponsor, Mr. Glasek, all excited. He's an economic development guy. He's all excited about the potential for this incentive and volunteers to go for it, puts in an application. Prior to our considering an application for new zones, we require that all taxing districts be notified, and their response will be part of the application process. And once a zone is established, the exemption applies. The three-year exemption applies to any business that goes through the certification or application process that's qualified. I haven't talked about what are qualified uses, but essentially at that point it's automatic and everybody's along for the ride with that business. So school districts, any taxing districts, cities, counties, will forego the taxes for 3 years. It's really good pay for 5 years, or if it's an exceptional investment and it's negotiated, 7 to 15 years.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Next question.
Yes.
Actually, I'd like to ask just a couple. I could. Madam Chair, Mr. Burton, how successful, in your opinion, has the enterprise zone system been in generating economic development and increasing, you know, jobs for Oregon?
Chair Smith, Representative Richardson, we actually prepared, it's preliminary at this point because we're still waiting for a little data, but a summary of exemptions in the last tax year, 2002, and they're being passed out now. We believe that this is a very effective program. We think, particularly given the tax structure in Oregon, that this is a compelling incentive. One of the things that Mr. Fish touched on is that typically when businesses are making an expansion decision or a locational decision, they'll look at the return on the investment they expect to generate over time. They'll typically adjust the costs and revenues to bring them to current dollars, the net present value analysis. We believe an incentive that minimizes their expenses in the early years will heavily weight that sort of an analysis. And I'm aware of at least one case in point where there's no question that the second expansion of Precision Castpart, second recent expansion, was because of an enterprise zone exemption. I also have personal experience in Central Oregon where a number of business folks will come to Bend to play. The economic development strategy is there. Get them to come and play, and maybe we can get them to stay. They come to look about staying, locate their business in Central Oregon, looking at Bend because Bend's the place they came for in the first place. But a lot of them end up in Redmond, and there are really two factors related to that. One is an enterprise zone. I have no doubt in my mind that the fact of this incentive early on in the life of a business, while it may still be getting started, getting established, and may not yet be profitable, is compelling to them. The other is the fact that there's 2,500 acres of industrial land in Redmond, and there's a couple hundred in Bend. So there's a place to do it. It's not a black and white situation, but we believe that this is an effective program, and almost every recruitment company asks if there is an enterprise zone exemption available. This is not unique to Oregon. It's something businesses are used to. And almost every one of them wants to know if there's an enterprise zone.
Out of the OECD's budget, what amount of funds are allotted for maintaining this program?
Chair Smith, Representative Richardson, we dedicate about half of Mr. Fish's time and then a piece of typically an individual on each of our regional teams. So it's probably on the order of one or two FTEs. And actually no cash outlays.
Okay. All right, thank you.
Is that it? Go ahead.
Chair Smith, I think it's important to note a couple of things given those questions. One is not all assets are exempt. On the third page, not all businesses are exempt. There's a list of qualified businesses. The easy way to get at this is essentially people who do most of their sales to consumers, retail sales, are not eligible. The one exception to that is one of the few local elections in this program, but depending on whether or not the zone sponsors collectively want to incent destination resort, hotel, motel development, they can opt to, at the beginning of the when the zone is designated, they can opt to allow for the incentive to apply to those kinds of facilities, destination resorts, hotels and motels. Otherwise, essentially, the program does not apply to retail businesses. So when I talk about qualified businesses, I'm primarily talking about manufacturing, distribution, and when I talk about qualified assets, I'm talking about real property improvements and capital equipment and large pieces of personal property.
Representative March. So engrossed.
Well, yes, it's very fascinating and this interesting information. And since this is preliminary, there's one other little piece I'd like, and that's sort of the cumulative value of all of the foregone taxes, basically. How much have we foregone to create these 7,300 jobs?
Chair Smith, Representative March, the ones in this report, this period, I believe that's totaled.
Well, it says current hypothetical property tax. Does that mean how much it is today on current value, or is that a cumulative number? That's the question.
Mr. Fish prepared this. We'll let him answer the question.
Yes, I know what you're referring to, Chair Smith, Representative Marsh, members of the committee. There is, as noted on the front page of my very rough stuff, which will eventually become some wonderful report that all committees and staff will have available if they like, but we're just getting going here and still bringing in some data and quality control. But on the bottom of the second page, there's the number of about 15.7 million. I say hypothetical because you don't know. I mean, we hope that some of those that property wouldn't have been there anyway, or mm-hmm. not necessarily anytime soon. So if it's foregone, maybe it's foregone and it never would have happened. Others, given the companies just, or something else would have happened there as well and paid taxes. But that 15.7 refers to this current year's property. If you want to know more or less what it would apply in general, you'd have to multiply that by 3.9, because the average the typical exemption only lasts 3 years, and then they're on the rolls, or the property is. But there are these 4 and 5 years, and some of those are the larger investments, the larger ones that pay the better and so forth. So I've calculated that the dollars per employee that we have there at about $7,400, which is pretty high. I was impressed. It comes out to about $8,300 per employee if you want to look at it that way.
Follow?
Yeah.
Is that the 73 into the 15, or is that the 73 into the 60, which is 3.9?
Yes, into the 60.
Okay.
Because you can't use just 1 year's, because right. There is, like I say, three plus years on average for these exemptions. So you have to kind of look at the whole savings for the company, in that way, and that's what we do.
Okay.
But we do have a lot of jobs. This goes back a ways, and the numbers, if I could do the records, we would have tens of thousands. How many of those businesses and jobs are exactly still operating, and there's all the taxes associated with it, but a lot of that property will be paying taxes now and will be.
And the jobs are paying income tax.
Yes. And again, we only count the full time. We don't count the suppliers, the part-timers, and some other things, which we can assume are positive out there. We're hopeful.
Let's hope so.
Yes.
Thank you.
Chair Smith, represent members of the committee. I think it's important to note that, I'll give you my opinion on this. I think the three-year exemption is a no-brainer. I think that to forego taxes of be $50 million in order to facilitate investment of hundreds of millions of dollars is a good deal, and tens of thousands of jobs over the life of the program. In the post-Measure 47 environment, there is a conflict with many of the taxing jurisdictions about that, because they're break-even ventures. They essentially deliver services and collect the cost of those services. When Measure 47 passed, the revenues were rolled back. So put it in perspective, I was working with the City of Albany on a project that would have been in excess of $30 million at $15 per thousand. I calculated that the annual property taxes would be $660,000. The City of Albany felt like it would cost $2 million to serve the site. So they wanted to collect $2 million from the company in systems development charges and fees. And the company ended up in Salem. Mr. Blasek will know the company. It's PPG. Because they weren't willing to pay $2 million to serve a site that cost them $500,000. But as I discussed it with the city manager was saying this argument about I'm not a for-profit business, I'm break-even, and I've got to cover my costs. But the taxes would have paid that $2 million in 3 years. Once the company started making payments, it's going to basically pay forever until the building falls down. So you give it up for 3 years, and after the company had been back paying taxes for 3 years, they would have paid back the city's cost of providing those services and providing access. So in my mind, the three-year program is a good thing. It works, and maybe it's because I'm the state and we're the state and we don't pay the bill, but it's a no-brainer in my mind. Some of 15 years in income taxes starts to be a lot, but we believe that in certain parts of the state that's a step that we need to take. I'm going to wrap up here because I've taken a lot of time. There's one additional piece, which is the e-commerce zone. E-commerce is a creation of the last legislature. E-commerce zones were approved for 5 zones, with one exception. They were existing enterprise zones. That's in the statute. There was an exception crafted by Representative Witt and the committee that related to North Plains, but the e-commerce exemption is an income tax credit equal to 25% of the investment in assets that facilitate electronic commerce. So it might be telephone switches, it might be computer systems and whatnot. The credit is applied against income taxes, so it assumes it's a profitable company. It likely is an existing company because it's got to have a profit. The tax credit can be carried forward for 5 years. So it's not a given that it's a profitable company, but for the incentive to be useful, it's probably got to be making money. So in a nutshell, that's quick and dirty overview of the Enterprise Zone program. I'd be happy to spend time getting into details with any of you who would like it.
Thank you.
And be happy to answer further questions.
Representative Pass?
Thank you. Do you have enough history yet on the e-commerce zone, Enterprise Zone, to see whether it's successful or not?
Chair Smith, Representative Haas, it's not. There is a technical glitch in the program that is a serious barrier that the department has prepared legislation that will be coming forward to you in the form of House Bill 2299. And we are trying to address that glitch in that bill. But there's a timing issue that basically makes it almost impossible for that vehicle to work.
But at the same time, the law has only been on the books 18 months anyway, so I think we don't have the history yet.
We have at least eight firms that are moving forward with investments that would qualify for the...
At least eight firms from somewhere else that want to set up there, or firms that were already here.
Chair Smith, members of the committee, Representative Haas, of this nine or so companies, and they're mostly in the two sort of Southwest Oregon e-commerce zones, I think a couple of them may be expansions, but several of them are new operations for those zones. So I think that's about as precise as I can get on that. But they haven't actually finished, they're just finishing their investments last year, so they're not necessarily reflected in any of the data I have here.
Thank you.
Just one question. Madam Chair, Mr. Gordon, is there any relationship between the enterprise zones and free trade zones, such as Medford Airport?
Chair Smith, Representative Richardson, only by coincidence, if not by design. There may be a coincidental location, but it's not part of the determination of either zone.
Thanks.
On the map, we put a little symbol for where there's this coincidence, but there's no relationship.
We should do that a lot down here. Mr. Glasick, would you like to go ahead?
Well, thank you very much, Chair Smith, and members of the committee. excuse me if I'm a little awkward in testifying before the committee. I'm not used to it, but I suspect by June I'll have it down pat.
I think you will.
Thank
for
you.
The record statement.
My name is Larry Glasick. I'm the president of SEDCOR, the Salem Economic Development Corporation, and the manager of the Salem Enterprise Zone. The Salem Enterprise Zone was created in that first bunch in, I think, 1988. At that time, for those of us who were around, we were going through a recession, and there was a firm in town called Siltec, and they were a silicon wafer manufacturer. And they were literally going through the financial wringer and were on the edge of closure. And through some various efforts, we found that there was a Japanese company called Mitsubishi who was interested in establishing a chip plant somewhere in the United States. And they learned about the problems of Siltec and thought that it might be an opportunity. So at that time, Governor Attia and the then Mayor of Salem, Sue Miller, signed a letter to Mitsubishi promising their best efforts to create an enterprise zone in Salem. And that was, I think, just before the legislature adopted the enterprise zone statutes. And so it was a commitment to pursue that. And we did. Mitsubishi bought Siltec, and thank goodness they did, because they have invested many hundreds of millions of dollars since then. The point is that the enterprise zone was pivotal to that decision. Probably the last 10 or 12 years, and I think staff will tell you that the Salem Enterprise Zone is probably one of the most active enterprise zones in the system. But we've dealt with approximately 60 companies, certified 60 companies. And I think this is really an important factor. 91% of those are existing companies. Existing companies. So, yes, it is a recruitment tool, but it is also a tool to help existing companies start up or expand an operation. Now back to Mitsubishi. When they were looking to expand in 1994, the Enterprise Zone also played a role. They were looking at a major expansion, about $500 million of expansion, and they were looking around the country for sites to do this expansion. And they were looking in Texas and North Carolina, and at our insistence, thank goodness we knew some of the people, they looked at Salem as well. But this was like a whole new recruitment program because you were dealing with the people in Salem. You had representatives from Japan, and there were some desires to be elsewhere for varying reasons, for instance, to be closer to some customers. But the Enterprise Zone was a critical factor in their decision once again in spending $500 million in Salem, Oregon. Incidentally, Mitsubishi is the only five-year Enterprise Zone we've done. I don't know how many others there are throughout the state, but there's only been one in our experience here. Since about since 1992, we believe the Enterprise Zone has been pivotal in creating about 3,500 jobs and close to $1 billion in new investment. And this, when you look at the Enterprise Zone, you can't characterize the monies not received from taxes as tax loss. It is an impact perhaps to the taxing districts, but in many cases, but not for the Enterprise Zone, that benefit, that investment would not have been there. And it would have not been in that time and not generating any taxes. The buildings, as we've indicated in the past, have a useful life that extend way beyond the 3-year. And like Mike Burton said, the payback of that quote lost revenue occurs somewhere in a 6 to 8 year time period. So the money is recaptured and the building goes on producing taxes for many years. In regard to the overall Enterprise Zone, it's our only base incentive in the state of Oregon. It's a very moderate incentive, and in these days of very sophisticated site selection efforts, the Enterprise Zone is asked for every time. They always come and ask, "What are your incentives?" And the Enterprise Zone is a critical factor to that discussion. I think if we didn't have it, I think that we'd be probably in worse shape than we are now. The other part is that almost every state has a form of Enterprise Zone. The statutes and what is provided is not like ours. In many cases, there's income tax forgiveness. There's other tax credits, many other things that go on to it that are much more expensive than what Oregon offers. So this is very, very moderate. The other part about the investments is we have to also look and factor in the residual benefits, such as, you know, the jobs, what that means to families in order to have those jobs and to feel good about themselves and to participate in the community, not to mention the income taxes that these create. Also, the companies that participate in this participate in civic activities. I mean, they support the little League and other civic projects. So, in my opinion, the Enterprise Zone, it's a winner. It's good for communities. It's good for the state. It's good for the workers. It's good for the economy. And it's good for the companies.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I tell you are impassioned.
I am passionate about it.
How do you think we compare with other states as far as our incentives in recruitment?
Well, I'm done line by line item. My impression from reading over some of these things in other states is that this is a very, very moderate incentive. I mean, this is all done with local real estate taxes. There's no, except in some of the new new factions of enterprise zone. You know, there's no income tax forgiveness, or, of course, we don't have a sales tax to forgive, so we don't have to deal with that. But some other states do.
And I, did I hear you yet?
If I can add something, Chair Smith, members of the committee, to that, I think, you know, while it's true that compared to a lot of states, we may not have the highest, most generous thing, it is fairly available. It's kind of a more rural-oriented program, despite some of the heavy activity in Salem and the other few urban zones. But one thing that companies do like about this, it's very much a statutory benefit. It's in the statute. So the base level, the 3 years, pretty much an automatic, and it's fairly straightforward compared to some of the procedural ways that other programs work in terms of what it takes for certification and so forth. So while it does and it has that immediate cash value that Mike referred to, so it's got some real positives, but as at a pure dollar value level, a lot of states have got bigger bells and whistles, to be sure.
Great, thank you. Representative Todd?
Thanks, Madam Chair. I'm interested, you obviously have some restrictions and some requirements built in that try and prevent a company from coming in one part of Oregon and going to an enterprise zone and just moving jobs instead of creating new jobs. Could you talk a little bit about what your experience has been? Has that, have the requirements and boundaries you've built in to try and prevent that been successful, or are there other things that are you're looking at to try and make sure that doesn't occur?
Chair Smith, Representative Hunt, there is a prohibition against receiving the enterprise zone benefit if you're decreasing jobs in another part of the state. And in our experience, that prohibition is effective.
Well, if I could ask one follow-up question. Based on the experience you've had, you've obviously brought forward a couple of tweaking bills along the way. Are there any other things you hear back from businesses, from the local governments you're partnering with, other things you've heard back in terms of critical feedback that would be constructive toward looking at other changes down the road?
Chair Smith, Representative Hunt, yes. The intent of the department's legislation is to reorder the statute. I think the biggest barrier, the program is felt to be complicated, and for the assessors and Department of Revenue, the role they have, which is not voluntary, they don't compete for these things, but they have some work land on them because of it. Our agenda in our legislation primarily is one to extend the sunset on the long-term rural exemption, which we think hasn't had a fair trial, and two, to reorder the statutes and sort of place them in chronological order so that you can start at the beginning with the designation of a zone and move to the end with the termination of a zone, but just follow through. We think there's been a lot of work on covering the bases in the statutes. And if people could follow through the statute in some sort of reasonable order instead of having to look all over the place to find the one little thing that you're looking for, I think it would help a lot. We also think that we need to clarify, ultimately, who has to do the work. And when Mr. Glasick volunteers for this, we think he ought to be volunteering to document employment and a bunch of the administrative stuff that doesn't legally have to fall to the tax assessors, and that the assessors who don't volunteer for this work should only have to do the stuff they have to do. So now we're not necessarily addressing those in the legislation we're proposing this time. We're trying to reorder the statute and not produce substantive changes, and we've come to an agreement that during the next interim we'll sit down and take a look at what those substantive changes might be and spend some time and work through those. We made a run at that in the last session and got rid of things that we thought were complications, and we even did that to a degree this time and found out from the experts that they were very substantive changes and had significant revenue impacts. So we called time out on those last time and agreed that we'd just do the reordering this time. And next time around, we're going to be sitting down with the people who matter and figuring out what we have to do to make things work better.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, I'd like to point out that Salem has been particularly successful in using this to a great advantage. I'm not sure what exactly has made this work for Salem better than some other areas, but I think a lot of the reason is sitting there. Mr. Glasick has been a wonderful administrator of this program and been very aggressive in making it work for Salem, and I would like to duplicate him around the state.
Good idea. Well, thank you, gentlemen.
Cloning.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Very good information, a lot to digest. I'd like to call Hasina Squires from Special Districts Association. She's going to give us a quick overview on how it affects enterprise zones affect our special districts. Welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm here today on behalf of the Special Districts Association of Oregon. I appreciate the opportunity to be very brief because I know you've got some very certified smart people in the back on a whole bunch of other issues. So I think the department, I want to just start off by saying that our association, we have no objections to the enterprise zone program. We're not here to make any judgments about whether or not it works or doesn't work. That's really an issue for you to decide in continuing the program since it was legislatively enacted and adopted. But our association represents approximately 800 special service districts throughout the state of Oregon. I know you've heard this pitch before, but including rural fire protection districts, water districts, irrigation districts, parks and recreation districts, a number of districts that provide the same types of services that cities and counties do to their citizens. Some of those districts are property tax, completely property tax reliant, and others are completely fee based services. So when the department characterizes the program as voluntary, it is voluntary in the sense that, and I think Representative March aptly picked up on this, it is voluntary in the sense that the zone creation is voluntary by either the city or the county, but it is not voluntary foregoing of property taxes by all taxing districts that are affected by the creation of the zone, specifically the special service districts. I think the department has done a very good job of hearing our concerns, and in 1999 instituted this automatic notification of special service districts, including school districts, to notify the either boundary expansion or creation of new enterprise zone. So our districts are more alert and aware that the zone is being created or that a zone is being expanded. But with the advent of Measure 47, foregoing property taxes is, in some cases, extremely harmful for some of our special districts, and I think you heard the department characterize most of the zones as rural-oriented, and rural-oriented rural fire protection districts are struggling, as are many other local governments. So I think our main point that we wanted to get across to the committee today and for this legislative session is that any new expansion of zones or creation of new enterprise zones, we will be advocating strongly for a provision that includes an opting out for special districts. Last legislative session, it's not an enterprise zone, but it was vertical housing zones. You'll hear about that later in your committee. It's fun stuff. I know Representative Hass is excited about that. the vertical housing zone, that legislation that passed last legislative session is not really a true enterprise zone bill, but contained language that allows local ORS 190 special districts to opt out of the creation of those zones. And that, we feel, just really affords special districts the same latitude as cities and counties. They're afforded the opportunity to choose to forego their property taxes. I'm sure when we get into the vertical housing zone, if we get into it, a couple have been created. Special districts were notified that they had the opportunity to opt out. Some did and some didn't. Some feel like they can contribute to the foregoing of the property taxes, and some just can't. So anything that comes before this committee or the revenue committee will have language in it. We'll be requesting amendments. And the department's bill that they referred to actually contains this language already, the 2299. But it really is a very serious issue in this day and age, and I'll just leave it at that.
Great. Thank you. Any questions for Hasina? Thank you very much.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Well, I'm going to close the informational meeting. on our Enterprise Zone overview. And I also want to tell the committee we're going to move the work session on House Bill 2252 to Monday when we meet again, just because we're running short on time and we want to be out of here. I'm going to open an informational meeting, overview presentation by the Oregon Council of Knowledge and Economic Development. And I have quite a few folks. Would you like to all come up at the same time? Or
Diane, how do you want to do it?
We are.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you.
Well, you guys decide. Just give us your name for the record, and we're here to listen. So thank you and welcome.
Thank you.
It's okay. Are these the certified smart people?
I don't know.
I hope so.
We should handle it.
If you need a few minutes to get ready, we can.
I think we're all set.
We're set. We're set. All right. Welcome. For the record, you need to state your name. And
okay. My name is Alan Alley. I'm the chairman of the Oregon Council for Knowledge and Economic Development. I'm also the CEO of Pixelworks in Tualatin, Oregon.
Great. I'm Frost Lee, and I'm a member of the OCED Committee and both the Tech Transfer and the Capital Access Committee, and I'm a physician from Bend, Oregon, and I have a software company in Bend.
My name is Scott Gibson, Gibson Enterprises. I serve on a number of boards of for-profit and not-for-profit companies and a member of OCED.
Thank you.
Okay. What I'd like to do is take you through a few overview slides about the situation that we have in the state of Oregon regarding technology and the growth of our technology-based economy, and then get into the Oregon Council for Knowledge and Economic Development, some of the specific recommendations that we've made that have been embodied in some Senate bills, a package of six bills, actually. And I think you've just got passed out a copy of the report that we just completed. First of all, the technology businesses are extremely important to the Oregon economy. The American Electronics Association, about every 2 years, does a survey of the various states. It's called the Cyber States Survey. And I was actually at a meeting about 2 years ago, opened it up, turned to the page on Oregon, and found out that high technology is actually the largest single employment sector in our state. And being in the high technology businesses and being a high technology executive, I didn't actually realize that that, in fact, had been the case. And this happened over about the past 15 years or so. In fact, I think it was 94, some, right around in that time, where it actually passed and became the largest sector. To show you how important this is, I flipped over, and when you look at California, actually, healthcare is the number one employer in the state in California. Technology is second, and agriculture is third. So in a way, you could argue that technology to the Oregon economy is at least as important as it is to the California economy. In fact, maybe technology is more important to our economy than it is to California. When you go on and look, there's actually only four states in the United States where technology is the leading employer in the state. And those four states are Oregon, Washington, Texas, and I think Texas is an excellent example of how they've moved from a natural resources-based economy to a technology-based economy. The fourth one was actually Georgia, a little bit of a surprise. The fifth one, and I think they've probably swung over recently in the past year or so, is actually Colorado, another example of moving from a resources-based economy to a technology-based economy. These are some of the statistics. You've seen these before. The jobs pay extraordinarily well. It's created quite a nice base for us to work off of. The other point that we wanted to make is technology workers are in those technology businesses like Intel and like my small company Pixelworks, but basically every business in the state has technology workers. Everybody uses computers in these businesses, and they're using them to leverage productivity to be competitive on a global scale. So when we're talking about technology and why it's important to the state, it's important as an industry sector, but it's also important for all the people and the businesses around the state. In some ways, we're actually doing pretty well competitively. Now, when you look at these statistics, you've got to remember we're one of only four states where technology is the leading employer in the state. So we're going to hold ourselves to a little bit higher standard. Typically, we're about 50th percentile in terms of population, so anything in the 20s or so would be normal for us. There's quite a few statistics where we rank below where we should. And in fact, many of those are in education. This is a statistic that you're probably aware of, but we actually rank 50th in high school completion rate. Now, this is especially concerning when you consider that the economy has moved over to a technology-based economy. And again, not just people working at Intel, but people working at businesses all across the state need to be technology literate. And when you're 50th in high school completion rate, it's awfully difficult to have people that are trained well to survive and thrive in those businesses. Other statistics that aren't especially flattering. And in fact, it was interesting to hear about the economic development zones, and I think those are important. What we're really trying to do is look at new ways of spawning economic development, given that the economy has shifted. Yesterday, I was actually in Munich, Germany, and I woke up to my copy of USA Today. This is the international version of USA Today. And there was this headline on the front page down here that says, college affordability is the worst in 10 years. Now, why is that important for us? Well, it's a very, very recent study. The other thing is that they said in this article that 14 states actually decreased support for their university system in 2001-2002 compared to the current biennium. Not a great group of states to be associated with. That means 36 states actually increased. The really disconcerting thing is they point out that Oregon posted the largest decline. Of the 50 states, we decreased our support for higher education more than any of the other 50 states at the same time that we raised tuition for both four-year institutions and two-year institutions and cut grant aid by 10%. Now, that's not a great position to be in, especially when our economy is so much based on an educated workforce. The other thing that was sobering for me is here I am in Munich going to meetings with the CEO of Infineon, and this is what's on the cover, and this is what he sees about my state. And he kind of looks at me with a funny look because it's like, geez, Alan, you're supposed to be a technology company. You're growing a technology company, yet you come from this state that manages to get on the front page of USA Today about how they're underinvesting in technology. The example that we use to compare the new economy, the new technology or idea-based economy, with the natural resources economy is a forest. The old growth trees are our universities and our big companies. The ideas are the pine cones. They require water. That's the money from the venture capitalists. And the soil is our knowledge workforce. Now, unfortunately, If this works out right, you grow new trees and you have a sustainable forest. Unfortunately, what's happened over the past several years is we've been harvesting the forest without reinvesting, as evidenced by things like the article in USA Today. Scott Gibson and I were talking the other day, and we had a lot of great companies that were started in the 80s here. I was involved with Infocus Systems and Planar, Sequent, Mentor. And if you think about the 90s, we really haven't had a lot of new technology companies that have grown to a size to be able to pay an awful lot of taxes during the 90s. In fact, my company was fortunate enough that we did grow up in the 90s, but there aren't very many that have. And it's roughly the equivalent of taking your old growth forest and clear cutting it. The thing that plants these new trees is our educational system, and we've really underfunded that educational system over this past decade. There's a dichotomy here that I find extraordinarily interesting. The fact that we're not funding this educational system to have excellence in education, yet individual Oregonians are spending a disproportionate amount of their wealth to have technology in the home. We're fifth in the nation in terms of the percentage of our households that have computers in the home. Now, think about it. This is the state with the highest dropout rate in the country. It's the state with the highest hunger rate in the country, but we're fifth in computers. We're also fifth in having those computers computers connected to the internet. So individually, Oregonians are stepping up and spending a disproportionate amount of their wealth to have the technology and to connect to the web, yet we're underfunding our educational system. And I think the gap arises from the people that I talk to just don't have faith that we're spending the money in the most prudent manner. And I think if we step up and we can prove to them that we're spending the money in a prudent manner, they will step up and they will actually spend more money in the educational system. Let me talk about the Oregon Council for Knowledge and Economic Development, a group that I've been able to chair for the past year. The members are a group of business leaders shown here, education leaders, and also political leaders, Republicans, Democrats, East, West. It's been a fabulous, fabulous group of people, extremely knowledgeable about how to grow businesses in this environment. One of the metrics is we've had 5 meetings over the past year. I think we had virtually 100% attendance at every one of those meetings with people with incredibly, incredibly busy schedules. The same thing goes for the subcommittees that we met. The objectives: increasing research and development, providing sufficient capital to grow these businesses, increasing tech transfer, and promoting our workforce development. We really focused on 3 areas and formed 3 subcommittees: research and tech transfer, chaired by Jim Johnson, capital and business formation by Scott Gibson, and the knowledge-based workforce development by Jill Kirk. I'm going to go through each one. I'm going to give you some highlights of the findings. Research and tech transfer, really, how do you sustain economic development given this new environment? The first recommendation is to establish signature research centers. Now, this is where we already have a core competency in the university system or in our various companies in this area. Where can we really focus and where can we build a center of excellence that can be as good or better than anything else in the world? We also wanted to be very specific about this. So the first research center that we're proposing is for miniature scale materials and devices for energy, environmental, and biological systems. And that's kind of a lot to say in one sentence. And for the real technical people, forgive me for my cartoon, but this is the way that I can explain it. If this is an old-fashioned radiator that used to sit, you know, by the windows in old buildings, you'd pump hot water through it. That hot water heats up the air around it, and that's what heated the building. What they found, and this is through research at Oregon State, University of Oregon, and Pacific Northwest Labs in Washington, is if you actually shrink these types of devices and make them very small, make them about the size of a penny or even smaller, they actually become much, much more efficient. You get more heat transfer than you would have through these big devices. And if you think about in nature, it occurs in like the leaves of a tree. And the very, very fine veins that go out into the leaf of the tree to either absorb moisture or absorb sunshine, absorb nutrients, that's the way nature works as well. The same kind of phenomenon happens. So what can you do with this? There's many, many different applications. You could create little tiny radiators for cars. Instead of having that big radiator in your car, you have little ones. If you have very, very small ones, you can seal up the front of the car, get dramatically better gas mileage because of less wind resistance. You don't have those big open holes. You can create, if you just flip the thing around, you can create air conditioning systems for protective suits. The same kind of technology works for creating fuel cells or batteries so that I could have a computer that could run for a week or a month off a little fuel cell. I don't have batteries that I have to throw away anymore. Same thing with my cell phone. The cost of this is about $10 million of startup capital and about $20 million in physical plant that we'd ask to invest. That would be bonded. It would be $10 million that would be the startup capital for it. Other recommendations, things like entrepreneurial leaves of absence and industry and residence programs where people from industry could go in and work at the university or people at the university can come work in a business like mine. Other things, OECDD, develop a technology roadmap for Oregon and identify other opportunities for signature research centers in the future. And like I said, all of these are embedded in the Senate bills that are going to be coming out. Many of these don't cost any money. They just require a little different focus. Promote the publicly supported tech transfer efforts. Last biennium, the Higher Education Technology Transfer Fund was created with $1, and we would like to get that funded with $4 million. Going forward, also $1 million of funding for tech transfer efforts for rural Oregon and traditional industries. Capital and business formation, this is really the rain. This is the venture capital. And how do we attract venture capital to Oregon? It was also interesting listening to the last session that we've got it pretty well figured out how do you attract traditional industries here, but how do you attract venture capital to the state? I actually have firsthand experience in this because I was a venture capitalist in Boston, and I actually moved to the state of Michigan. And the reason I moved to the state of Michigan was Michigan invested in our fund in Boston and asked us to put somebody in Michigan. One of the outgrowths of that was while I was there, I met some people that started a seed fund that's now grown into a $120 million seed fund in the state of Michigan. I'm in Oregon now, but that seed fund is still there. So part of it is to just work with OECDD to look at venture capital as a sector and really focus on recruiting venture capital. We also have a proposal of specifically how to do that. Venture firms are made up of individuals. The partners in the venture firms really control the money in that venture firm. How do you recruit a partner in a venture firm to move here to Oregon? There must be some tax incentives or some things that we could do in order to do that. We have a very crisp set of proposals on how you would do it. And it's just economic development in the same way that we used to recruit companies here. We're now recruiting individuals here that have the ability to invest in companies in the future. And again, since those individuals don't live here right now and you're recruiting them to the state, just like other economic development things, you're not taking away from your existing tax base. In our workforce development, what we really focused on first was what kinds of things can we do for the incumbent workers, the people that are already working here, that are already in these companies, training them on things like Microsoft Office tools or database tools. The example I use for my own company is 95% of our sales are outside of the country. 90% of those sales are in Asia. I'd love to have some great Asian language programs in the community colleges that my people could take advantage of. They don't need a degree in Chinese. They don't need a degree in Asian language studies. What they need is some coursework that would help them. I call it taxicab Mandarin, so that they can get around and not get lost when they are in China. The other thing is to absolutely support the recommendations of the Engineering Technology Industry Council, ETIC, for doubling the engineering graduates and creating a top-tier engineering school. I think this is absolutely core to what we're doing, and with your help, we've already embarked on that mission over the past couple of biennia. The other thing is there's just some things that we can do to get kids more exposed to technology businesses. There's the International Science Fair that's coming to Portland in 2004. This is the biggest science fair in the world. It's sponsored by Intel as the major corporate sponsor. I don't think it's ever been here before. 1,200 kids from all over the world, Nobel laureates coming here. At the last fair, Oregon had one team. One representative at the science fair. Just something simple to get 10 teams at this one would be a great step forward. Just in summation, I'd like to quote from Darwin, where he said, "It's not the strongest of the species that survive, nor the most intelligent, but the ones most responsive to change." And we certainly understand the budget concerns that you're going through and the difficult cuts that you have to make. I think the thing is that if we don't do something different in the future, we're going to be doing this again. And we really believe these are very, very highly leveraged areas where we can promote and sustain economic development in the future. Because if we just make those cuts, all we're going to end up with is a smaller version of exactly what we have today. And I don't think anybody is really too enthusiastic about the balance of what we have today. I think we really have to make some decisions about where to make those cuts and then what to invest in the future. And we believe this is a very highly leveraged place to do that. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
let me just briefly focus on a couple of points that I think are extremely important, is that what came out of OCHED was a synergy between the legislative efforts and industry and universities. And when we looked at this whole process in terms of looking at how to stimulate the Oregon economy, you know, we were definitely directed towards looking at knowledge-based solutions for this in terms of what are our assets and what can we draw on. And if you look at the plan in detail, you'll see a couple of things that are really important. The first of which is that this is definitely a statewide program. You know, I live in Bend. I grew up in an itty-bitty tiny place called Rufus. I practiced medicine for 17 years in Newport on the Oregon coast. You know, they're in the long list of, except for Bend at the moment, in economically deprived areas. And when we're talking about, you know, knowledge-based economy and stimulating the economy with producing more jobs from universities, this is what we're talking about. And we're talking about something that impacts the entire state. It impacts industry that we know already exists here. It leverages the strength that we have in particular. And one of the things that we looked at was we can't wait for results. You know, we cannot wait for a long-term project. So when we looked at the signature research, and I'm here specifically focusing on the tech transfer piece, is we said, what's the shortest distance that we can get some results in? What are our strengths? What can we do to leverage those things? And one of the things that was very consistent across this is that we already have a significant presence in a national and an international level, and we have this, what I call the pluripotential. It's following up on the Darwin statement, to be able to really maximize change here and be able to have a direct line of sight between the strength that exists across our universities, not competitively, but cooperatively, again, with the higher education or community colleges, with a direct line of sight to industries that already exist. Now, these are industries that are in Oregon, that are already here.
I'm sorry, Dana, can you lean back? Madam,
yes.
Can you lean back just a little bit? It's muddling in the...
Fine. Thank you. So, you know, if you look at the areas that I mentioned, you know, what we have is we have strength already in industries that are medical device industries in the state. We have imaging industries. We have technology industries. And when you look very specifically at the first signature research, which is for the nanotechnology, it's across the board. It's everything from medical devices and the potential to rapidly be able to get federal matching funding to infuse that into the Oregon economy to translate into jobs in the next 2 years. You know, though this is a long-range plan that's sustainable, we expect to see results from this within 2 years. And even by sort of putting your stake in the ground and saying, all right, this is a focus area, we're already beginning to see things happen, particularly between PNL and Oregon State University and the University of Oregon. So this is happening right now.
Great. Thank you. Mr. Gibson?
Yes, Madam Chair, esteemed members of the committee, sorry to keep you sitting a little bit longer. My name is Scott Gibson, as I've said. I came to Oregon in 1978 through Intel, where I was general manager of one of their chip divisions here. I co-founded Sequent Computer in 1983 and helped it grow from a startup to employing 2,700 people 12 years later and achieving $800 million in annual sales. I tell you that only to illustrate how young companies and startups really can be a lifeblood for this, as an ointment for our economic woes. I've worked as a member of the board of directors with numerous Oregon high-tech companies for the last 10 years and have helped several to grow from small companies to successful public companies. Radisys Corporation, where I'm chairman of the board, TriQuint Semiconductor, and IMS. I am also a member of the board of Northwest Natural and Pixelworks, Oregon Health and Science University, the Oregon Health and Science University Foundation, and the Oregon Community Foundation. My wife, Pam, and I have been married for 23 years and have raised two boys here. Like you all here today, we are Oregonians, and our commitment and love of our state runs deep. I am also here today because I understand and care deeply about what Oregon can and must do this biennium to grow our economy. In my industry, you either grow or perish. You either constantly invest in new products and new ideas, or you wither. I see other states such as New York, Utah, and Kentucky investing even during these tough economic times that we're all suffering through. worse, I see other countries, China and India particularly, as even greater competition for Oregon's chip manufacturing and our engineering brain power. So we must do all that we can to help nurture our key industries while birthing sensible and differentiated new industries. The last legislature made a key investment in the Oregon opportunity, and we thank you for that. And that will prove to be a great investment. But venture capital is a critical missing link to help commercialize the additional discoveries coming out of Oregon Health and Science University. As an example of the challenge, there are virtually no deep pocket life science venture capitalists present in Oregon. OCHED has a plan. OCHED, as Alan mentioned, composed of leading business, university, and elected leaders, unanimously agreed on what to do for Oregon's future after 15 months of hard work, expert testimony, thought, and discussion. Many of our recommendations would cost our state nothing. Some would cost political will and require bipartisan support to pass our bills. And one of our bills would require investment to birth a new industry harnessing world-class intellectual property already existing in the Oregon University system. I have participated heavily in the OCHED, chairing its Capital and Business Formation Committee. I have participated directly in venture capital fundraising and have secured over $100 million of venture investment for my Oregon companies during the last 20 years. Venture capital is the rain Alan Alley mentioned in his presentation. Venture capital partners are the rainmakers. Both are a necessity for growing a great forest relatively quickly. We can and must focus on attracting existing venture capital partners, those currently living in California and Washington, to move their primary residence to Oregon. Our two bills can make this happen. This is the only quick way to bring large amounts of capital, the lifeblood of startups, to Oregon. Our second initiative also costs our state nothing. We have already begun coordinating foundations who invest small amounts of their endowment in venture capital already to invest in a few top-tier venture capitalists that are willing to prospect in Oregon. I'm proud to say OHSU Foundation has taken the lead in this with its first step of committing $4 million of its corpus split between Alloy Ventures of California and OVP of Oregon and Washington. It was no accident that our governor has already visited Alloy Ventures in the Bay Area. Eliminating capital gains in a revenue-neutral way will further attract venture capitalists and entrepreneurs, as capital gains is their scorecard. It's their lifeblood. This would also stabilize our funding base, since we're not enjoying as a state any real capital gains revenue at the moment. Our committee has made another recommendation which would cost our state nothing but political will, which we estimate would result in $500 million to $1 billion of available capital moving to our state, but moving here in a very non-traditional way. Our goal is attracting a maximum of 7 to 10 individual partners of top venture capital firms from California and Washington and getting them to move their primary residence to Oregon. This is achievable, but we cannot fish with only Oregon's livability as our bait. Just as companies are attracted here by incentives, so too can a handful of these venture rainmakers who also value our livability. They can be attracted here. These 7 to 10 men and women will change this state's economy in a profound way, birthing clean industry, companies paying high wages and generating jobs and taxes, which will help pay for much-needed state services. These legislative bills represent our best thinking, and we are here to work with you to find solutions that reach our shared goals on renewed economic prosperity for all in Oregon. Thank you.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you.
We have about 10 minutes left. Do we have any questions, or if we have questions, you want to
wait? Well, I have a question, which really, if you had the opportunity to see the floor debate today, it's just a taste of some of the difficulties and choices that we've got to make. And you mentioned both K through 12 and higher ed, so my question isn't really to, it's just to provoke maybe some perspective. And what would your recommendation be? I mean, should we be investing in K through 12 at the expense of higher ed, or investing in higher ed, you know, to benefit K through 12? Kind of help us balance.
I can take a shot at it. It is an extremely difficult question, and I think it's somewhat near-term, long-term type view of things. Higher ed is getting headlines. I mean, when we're on the front page of USA Today in Munich about how we've underinvested in higher ed, it's increasingly difficult to convince the world community that this is a place to build technology-based companies and to invest in this. And it's very, 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 very visible. The problem with K through 12 is as soon as they get here, that's the very next thing that you hear about, is that we've got the shortest school years in the country. I think the bottom line is we have to invest in education. I mentioned this gap where Oregonians spend a lot of money on computers and internet access, yet we're, quote, underfunding our educational system. As I traveled around the state talking to people about OCED, nobody said that they wanted to have poor schools. Nobody said that they were proud of what we have. In fact, they're very passionate about education for their kids. And this is everybody from Burns, Baker City, Joseph, and here in the Willamette Valley. I think what we have to do is we have to step up, we have to make some changes, communicate that to the people, and then say, look, once we make these changes and we start to produce some results, we're going to come back and we're going to ask for more money. We're going to come back with Measure 28 or something like that. And then we're going to fund the schools, because I think there's an inherent passion in Oregon not to have just okay schools, but to have top-tier schools. So I think it's a short-term, long-term type thing. Just one other comment. Measure 28 got, you know, people say it got killed, you know, 55-45. Well, when I walk around the state, I can't tell the difference between 55% and 45%. To me, it was pretty much a 50-50 split, which I think is a huge step in the right direction. So I think by showing some leadership, saying what we're going to do, saying where we're going to cut, where we're going to invest, I think there's an opportunity to go back and get the proper level of funding.
I would just add, whatever your politics, I think the governor's kicked this off on the right note of no more continued service levels. We have to reestablish the citizens' trust in government, that we're spending their money wisely. You all have taken courageous action rapidly on PERS reform. These are the things that I think really cue us up in the next biennium, then to go back with a change in our state tax system that we all know we need. And I can say that passionately. So, but first has to be the credibility, and we didn't have that, and I think that's why we were in this loop of the voters won't give us more money because they don't think we're spending it wisely. Whether we are or we aren't, that's the perception. Perception's reality.
Let me add just two other points, is that in a tough economic time like we have here, we've got a couple issues that impact higher education. The first of which is that one is hope, which is that when we look at having better jobs, better things for our children, we're looking at, you know, training and hope and education. And I can certainly say from my standpoint that hits two things, one of which is that in order to develop the type of economy that we want, we are unfortunately not blessing the higher ed, nor are we blessing the K-12 piece in a way that is attracting the kind of people we want to keep here. In addition, we are losing our talent outside of the state because we're not blessing higher education. We have a good and long-standing tradition, and certainly, you know, my ability to come from some very small places and be able to get a good education, in fact an excellent education, is because of what exists in Oregon. So I'm certainly a product of that, and would like to see us, you know, really make some efforts to balance that and first do the hope piece, which say, you know, look, there is a way for you to get a good job, a good education in the state, and look at that from higher ed and then come back and pull that in. The second point is that we also have a stellar educational program that rates in terms of top for education possibilities. For teaching at the University of Oregon. So we already have, you know, an imbalance in terms of what we're able to maximize in the state, and we need to put some light on that and say we really do a very good job here.
Point.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
That was an excellent presentation. It really was. And this is a comment. It's not just USA Today. It's the New York Times. And it's Good Morning America.
Yeah.
I guess the one question I have, Scott, you mentioned that we have a plan to get those guys moving up here or down or from wherever.
Is that a plan that's coalescing through with legislation, and where is it?
Yes, we had six bills move from the Senate committee that we presented to this morning. All six were passed on to the next stage in the process, so with unanimous support, I might add. That particular one is Senate Bill 362, but it's Senate Bill 358 through Senate Bill 363. Those are the six bills that package up everything we're recommending and are moving it through the process. We realize we'll have to work with you to incorporate or modify things in this current environment, and we stand willing to do that as volunteers.
Representative Hunt.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I thought Representative Gallegos' question was right on target, and I'm wondering, since to some degree you kind of all punted on that question, and I understand why, I'm wondering if there are things, since our focus here is really economic development, are there things that you may perceive that we ascribe or a high value to economic development that are state services or state costs that maybe from your perspective aren't as high? I mean, even breaking out of the educational realm, we're looking at the kind of budget choices we're going to have to make. You're asking for some new dollars, which is reasonable. But are there things that we may ascribe to these are actually good for economic development that maybe aren't as important as these?
I'll cue up a controversial one, but one I think is very debatable, and that is, I think rightfully so, in the times of boom, we spent a lot of the economic development budget on community development, and that was a great time to do that. But I think we weakened the overall engine of growth and by doing that, but that was a good trade-off for the 90s. I don't think that's currently a good trade-off, in that if the overall engine is sputtering, then everyone, rural or urban, suffers in the state. So we've got to get the engine back to health, and to me that means really focusing on birthing some industries that diversify our economy. Our signature research center, we've agonized over all kinds of different differentiated areas and picked one that we really think can make a rapid difference, can birth 15 companies in the next 3 years, and I believe the number was 28 companies by 2010. And it's an area that has wide application, and for $20 million in capital and $10 million of startup costs, just the federal research it'll bring in alone, I think this thing is somewhat of a no-brainer. But I'm very sensitive that saying that in an environment with melting revenues melting away. The gentleman from Hewlett-Packard this morning, I think, said it best. He said, you know, when their R&D budget was being cut to shreds in the last 2 years, they took the courageous decision of saying, you know, even with the declining R&D budget, we're going to take 10% of a declining number and we're going to put it into brand new areas to try and have some breakout kind of opportunities. And he said, you know what, that was so painful 2 years ago, and it was the best decision we ever made.
Let me just make a comment. We did dodge the question, and let me answer it in a more straightforward manner. We've actually looked into it a little bit, and some anecdotal data. If you look at the amount of money we spend per student in K through 12, we're above average. We're not in the bottom. We're a little bit above average. If you look at teachers' salaries, we're actually right about in the middle in terms of teacher salaries. But if you look at the number of kids per classroom, we actually have one of the worst student-teacher ratios. And if you take all that data and you synthesize it, it means Oregon spends more on stuff other than teacher salaries than any other state in the country. So we're spending more on other things, and unfortunately that's where my data ends. I don't know what those other things are than any other state in the country. So my conclusion as a business person is there's probably opportunities for finding out what are all of those other things that we spend on and focusing on those. Once we do that, and once we say, yes, we do spend more on those other things, here they are, this is what we should be spending, making those appropriate cuts, I think you can go back to the voters and you can say, now we want to spend more on teachers, we want to spend more on reducing the classroom size, and I think you can get the voters to sign up to that. So that's my specific.
Thank you very much. We unfortunately are out of time.
Okay.
Thank you so much for providing this committee with a great overview.
Thank you.
With that, I'll close the informational. And there being no further business before the committee, I'll adjourn.
Stand up.
Yeah.